The Edmund Fitzgerald was an American Great Lakes freighter that sank in Lake Superior during a storm on November 10, 1975, with the loss of the entire crew of 29 people. When launched on June 7, 1958, she was the largest ship on North America's Great Lakes, and she remains the largest to have sunk there. She was located in deep water on November 14, 1975, by a U.S. Navy aircraft detecting magnetic anomalies and found soon afterwards to be in two large pieces. How many shipwrecks have there been in the Great Lakes, and how many people have died? In a moment, our special guest Rick Mixter joins us. His latest work is called Bottled Goodbyes, Aviation and Maritime Disasters. We will talk about the Great Lakes in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Rick Mixter with us, author, former television news reporter, historian. Rick specializes in maritime and aviation history. He's been awarded by the Association for Great Lakes Maritime History, featured on PBS and the History Channel, served as president of the Great Lakes Lighthouse Keepers Association, and is one of the most requested speakers on the Great Lakes. He's versed in everything from shipwrecks to lighthouses and even aviation out there. His book is called Bottled Goodbyes, Aviation and Maritime Disasters, also The Wheelsman. Rick, welcome to the show. I'm looking forward to this.
George, as well, this is a real highlight of my career to talk to you, sir. I appreciate it.
I'm going to tell you an interesting story. Back on November 10th, 1975, I'm a producer at WJBK in Detroit, and this about 6:30, 7 o'clock, something like that, there's a little clip on the Associated Press newswire that said there's a ship missing at Lake Superior. And I said, my gosh. So we had a night crew working for us, two guys, Les Walden and Ken Schneer, the sound man. Les was the cameraman. And the reporter was a fellow by the name of Ron Sanders. And I said, what the heck? You know, we're not doing anything tonight. Go. And I sent him out there. And my news director called me up, Rick, and he went nuts. He said, what are you spending all that money for on a missing ship? And I said, Dick, his name was Dick Graff at the time. He's dead now. And I said, Dick, I have a hunch that this is a huge story. And look what happened. CBS News used our video footage the next day. What we had, Rick, are things from the ship that floated to shore. It was absolutely chilling. But what a story. And then after Gordon Lightfoot did his thing, I mean, it lives in memory forever, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. And I'm surprised even, you know, 46 years later, we're still chatting about it in lectures and in so many stories that come out. So, yeah, what an amazing story you have, though, of a personal tie to it.
What television market were you in?
Out of those Bay City, Saginaw, but I was born and raised up in the UP, so I worked at Channel 6 as one of my first stations, in addition to a bunch of radio stations. So a great career in Michigan and just incredible stories that included a lot of shipwrecks.
Absolutely. What a monumental story that was. How many ships and people have been lost in the Great Lakes?
We've been arguing that as historians forever because, you know, it's tough to get an exact number, but it's over 15,000 shipwrecks that have been lost. We still believe that there's at least 5,000 that we haven't found, that the lakes are just so vast and so deep. You know, Lake Superior is up to 1,300 feet deep, that there's some that we may never find. But with our new technology, we're finding a lot of them, and we did this past summer.
And so many men and women have been lost as well. That's tragic.
Oh, 250,000 sailors, 25,000 sailors, forgive me, lost, men and women, yeah, that and passengers that were on these ships.
I had heard that the Edmund Fitzgerald was top-heavy with iron ore and that it got hit by either three massive waves. The winds were like 50 miles an hour. What has been the official version of what happened to that ship?
That's why I think we continue to argue, because there's no real official. I've done interviews with former sailors, with the men who have built the Edmund Fitzgerald, with the investigators from Jean-Michel Cousteau all the way to the Coast Guard, and everybody disagrees. So I believe that there was a massive wave. When I dove it in 1994 in a tiny submarine, I saw hatch number one was folded in by what apparently was a massive wave, and the account of the captain that was behind them, Captain Cooper on the Anderson, he said that wave hit them and damaged their lifeboat, and that was 30 feet above the water. So I believe that massive wave is what hit the Fitzgerald at 710. It drove its snows on there, and because she had been weighed down by a lot of excess water, and we know the captain said he had a couple of vents missing, which were 8-inch holes in the deck, and then the hatches also, a good possibility those hatches were not all dogged down, as borne out by what I saw underwater of some of the hatch clamps that were damaged and some weren't. So all of this water coming in is what made her very susceptible to that killer wave that brought her under before they could even call for help.
Did they ever go down and get the 29 bodies, or were they ever discovered?
Yes. As a matter of fact, they didn't go down to get them, but the Coast Guard went down for 3 days and looked and found nothing. Whitefish Point sent a diver, or a robot down in 89. Jacques Cousteau was down there for a half hour. None of them reported a body. But during our dive in 94, in fact, the exact dive right after my submersible visit, we came up. The owner of the tugboat that we were operating from took his son down to see the wreck, and they were the first ones to find a missing crewman. So it was a very sobering time for us to really unlock that mystery in the song that Lake Superior never gives up its dead, and that certainly happened on our dive.
Rick, paint a picture for us. Put us on the ship that very, very fateful night, and explain what's going on weather-wise, what's happening to the ship, and what happens when it goes down, and why the 29 could not get away.
Absolutely. The two ships were following each other through the storm. They had taken a very northern route to try to avoid the building waves. As the low front pushes up into Canada, it actually changed the direction of the wind, and now the wind's coming out of the northwest, and it's screaming at 70 miles an hour. That's building 150 miles of fetch, or the distance that the waves can be pushed. So these killer waves are now starting to pound into the Whitefish Point area. The captains made a choice to continue on. They threaded their way between Michipicoten Island and Caribou Island. North of Caribou is some dangerous shoals that many people believe it might have run aground there. I don't personally believe that. The Coast Guard didn't believe that. But as they came through, they reported some damage. They said that they had a fence rail down. They said they had some vents missing, and that water was coming in, and they were pumping it out with every pump that they had. So here comes this big wave that hit the Anderson and sped past the Anderson about 9 miles ahead until it hit the Fitzgerald in a blinding snowstorm. The people on board the Anderson were watching the Fitzgerald at that time. They were trying to keep the distance between some saltwater vessels that were coming out of Whitefish Bay, and their job was to warn the Fitz if they got close. Well, they look at the radar. They can't see anything. All they can see is a blob on the radar, and through their binoculars at night, they're looking for the lights of the Fitzgerald. They can't see them, and when it all clears up, the Fitzgerald's gone, and then becomes the quest of them trying to contact the Coast Guard to convince them that a 700-foot-long freighter, one of the larger ones on the Great Lakes, was missing with 29 lives, and nobody believed it.
How quickly do you think it got swallowed up by the sea?
Many people believe it was in seconds. I mean, that's borne out by the fact that there's three radios on the Fitzgerald. One was battery-powered, and nobody got a call out for help. So they're talking back and forth to the Anderson. They're talking to the first mate, Morgan Clark. And Morgan Clark is talking about the saltwater vessels ahead of them. And he said, hey, by the way, how are you holding out with those problems you reported? And the Fitzgerald's captain, McSorley, said, we're holding our own. And within moments after that, that wave must have just pushed in, collapsed that the first hatch, and just they couldn't recover. They couldn't come back from the big wave that pushed their nose under, and she ripped into two major pieces and went down in seconds.
And there's no way they could have even ditched, because even if they were in little lifeboats, those would have been capsized too.
Yeah, the lifeboats have never been effective. This is also the anniversary today of the 1913 storm, where 250 sailors were lost in one weekend.
Oh, my God.
12 ships vanished with all of their crew. Lifeboats have always come ashore with either frozen people inside or empty. And in the Fitzgerald's case, one was cut in half, allegedly by the propeller. Another one was just split by its rapid ascension from the wreck. It tore away from the davits as the Fitz went down and rolled over on the stern section. And then two inflatables came ashore with no one in them, and there was no evidence that anybody ever got into them. So it was so fast they didn't have a chance to even get out on deck to try to get to the lifeboats, which was quite different from many of the other gales that we've seen even in 19. 1958, the Bradley that went down, the Morrell went down in 66. There were survivors from there, and that's what added to that mystery of, think, 29 people vanishing in 1975 when we thought we had technology that, you know, we could find them or at least track them.
Was there any negligence involved, in your opinion?
Absolutely. I hate to speak ill of the dead, but there's no question that it was the captain's fault. I mean, this is a, when you look at, you know, the journey you're making, and that captain, the Coast Guard looked into his record. He was the one captain that continued to push through most of the storms over the last decade coming into the Sioux. So he pushed a ship that was in ripe shape. I mean, it was by many accounts from the cook and other people who wintered on the ship, it had some structural issues. And the many people who sailed on it said it just really bent a lot. I mean, ships normally flex in storms, but the Edmund Fitzgerald seemed to really flex in even just 10-foot waves. So the negligence was a captain who thought he could make it through, and quite frankly, Cooper, who's behind him, believed that his ship was infallible. He said that in an interview. I share that with a lot of people. They believe those ships were indestructible. They believe they'll get them through, and unfortunately for the 29 men on board, they didn't make it. It was a bad call.
Yeah, why didn't anything happen to the other ship?
That mostly because it wasn't leaking the way the Fitzgerald was. It didn't have the topside damage. Anderson was a little bit bigger than the Fitzgerald. It was slower, but it, you know, 80 feet bigger. And basically, he cut the corner and had the storm on his stern. The Fitzgerald was taking in water. I'm convinced it was coming in through any one of those 21 hatches that are on there. And also the vent pipe, it was pouring into their ballast, and they could not pump it out fast enough. So here she is lower in the water with very little freeboard, the distance between the waves and the deck. And when that big wave came up, it pushed her under, and there was no way to recover. By the time it went under, the last second and third hatch blew off in an explosion of air pressure, and it just catastrophically, you know, flooded. And we can still see, I mean, my submarine actually went right over hatch number one that's dented in from what that wave did. So there's no question in my mind it was definitely that wave.
Who was Edmund Fitzgerald, Rick?
He was the president of Northwest Mutual Life Insurance, which it sounds odd, but Northwest Mutual, as of 1957, had three different freighters they were using to help raise their stock portfolio. You know, you've got to raise money when you're a life insurance company to pay out to the policies, and the investment into railroad and real estate was a big deal for them. But going into shipping was something brand new, and they decided they would build the largest object ever dropped into fresh water. In 1957, 700 feet long was the maximum you could get through the Sioux Locks. It was, in fact, they decided after that one to build two more ships in Detroit, or in River Rouge area, right by Detroit, that would be a foot bigger, and the Army Corps of Engineers finally told them, you can't go bigger than that. So here's this 700-foot freighter that came out, launched in 1958. It was the biggest that had ever gone in to the Detroit River and certainly on the Great Lakes, and it broke cargo hauling records with 30,000 tons on board, which was unheard of.
When Gordon Lightfoot did the song, did it really increase the notoriety of the wreck?
It really did. I mean, I've got to say he's the patron saint of maritime history and railroad, for that matter. I mean, he wrote a lot of songs about the railroad, too. But his song about the Fitzgerald launched essentially my career and so many people who tell stories on the Great Lakes. Every museum seems to have a piece of the wreck. There's the life raft, the inflatables in Toledo at the National Marine Museum. Whitefish Point has many pieces, including the bell, and the lifeboats are at Valley Camp Museum. So everybody seems to have a piece of it. But it Edmund Fitzgerald's song was the one that really pushed it. It went to number two on the charts, and it was so long, 6 minutes, and it was that haunting guitar by Terry Clement, a Detroit native, that just really made, you know, that song stick out. It wasn't his biggest hit, but it certainly, I think, is the legacy that he'll always live behind.
Was it haunting for you in the sub being down there?
It really was. I mean, as we went down 500 feet, as you go below 200 feet, you lose all sunlight. So it gets very dark by 300, 400, and now you're at 550 feet. And it's so cold, it's 35 degrees down there, that the submarine sweats. So here I am in this two-person submarine with water in the bottom. And I'm very nervous that, you know, we're not going to make it. And I'm trying to tell the pilot, hey, there's water in the submarine. But he convinced me it was just from the condensation of our breathing. And it was no big deal. He said a leak at that depth would have cut me in half. So I totally understood. But to see the wreck, it's totally sobering. I mean, you're seeing the letters that are, you know, huge through a porthole, and it seems surreal when you look at it. And so you're excited about seeing the wreck that you've heard on the radio forever, the largest shipwreck on the Great Lakes, the most famous shipwreck on the Great Lakes. But then you realize it's a gravesite, and you just get this emotional roller coaster of just being devastated to know that there's 29 men that are down there. So for us, it was that emotions that went up and down, and it was exciting, it was sad, and it was very difficult and trying.
It's got to be eerie. I think it was very eerie when they discovered the Titanic, much the same kind of way in terms of looking at it from a ship. It's weird, isn't it?
It is, and when you spend, you know, well over an hour and a half down there, I mean, we were lost for much of that. Unfortunately, the iron ore and the metal throws off your compass, and we're trying to find our way around. But the truth is, we saw so much devastation that had never been reported that you're just awestruck by it, and you're trying to take mental notes. And luckily, you know, we had cameras on board. I'm a videographer. We sent down another videographer as well that, you know, we could capture these things to review later on, because it's too much to take in when you're down there. I'm just really lucky that we have hours and hours of videotape that we can go through that's much more clear than the stuff that the Coast Guard had to really try to paint the picture of what happened.
Every time you hear the song I just played by Lightfoot, how do you feel? Is it chilling for you?
Yeah, it's chilling, but I'll be honest, there's some inaccuracies in there, and a lot of people get down on me for making fun of Lightfoot, and I'm not making fun of him. I just know that he just recently changed the lyric about the hatchway giving him because he felt it was inaccurate, but I know it's actually accurate. I wish he would have changed, you know, fully loaded for Cleveland. It wasn't going to Cleveland, it was going to Detroit. Or I wish he would have changed, you know, coming back from some mill in Wisconsin. There was no mill. The mill was in Minnesota. They loaded in Wisconsin. So, and the old cook coming on deck, I know through my interviews that I met the old cook who actually lived, Red Bergner. So there's a lot of inaccuracies, but as many people tell me, that song is not a documentary, Rick. That song is, you know, it's just a song. But because he changed it, he changed the lyric on the musty old church in Detroit. As you know, Mariners Church is a beautiful church.
And
it's hardly musty. But I wish he would have changed those other inaccuracies. The old cook did not come on deck and say, fellas, it's been good to know you, because the old cook or Rafferty didn't know everybody on board. So there's enough things that I wish that would have been changed. But still, every time you hear it, the guitar is just what takes me away. And the lyrics that he wrote, does anyone know where the love of God goes when the waves turn the minutes to hours? I want to cry. It devastates you. That's how he's putting what it's like when time stands still, when these waves are tearing your ship apart.
Rick, we'll be back in a moment here, and we'll continue talking about the Great Lakes and the tragedies out there. Rick's book is Bottled Goodbyes. His websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Put your maritime cap on and make a call next hour with Rick Mixter as we talk about the wrecks and disasters in the Great Lakes. I'd love to hear from you when we take calls next hour, of course. We'll be back with him in a moment as we'll talk more about his incredible work. His book is called Bottled Goodbyes, Aviation and Maritime Disasters. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie back with Rick Mixter. Rick, tell us about the title, Bottled Goodbyes.
It's literally the title that I came up with years ago, because as I looked at shipwrecks, I'd noticed there was a lot of messages in the bottle, and I thought, boy, if I ever get a second to put together a story on this, I'm going to do it. And boy, when COVID hit and put us into quarantine, I lost my job, and I thought, what am I going to do now? And I thought, this is the time. So this is a 240-page book on all the messages in a bottle found in the ocean and especially the Great Lakes.
Wow. Is there a shipwreck you would love to come across that you haven't yet?
Oh, there's so many of them on the Great Lakes, especially. The Le Griffon is the first shipwreck on the Upper Great Lakes, the first one to be lost in a storm, September of 1679, where La Salle was here exploring. They don't know what happened to it. It's been reportedly found since the 1930s at least 50 times, and it's never turned up. So we know that there's a ship with cannons on the Great Lakes someplace, and eventually we'll find it, and it's 300 years old. So that would be a top of my list.
With incredible technology, why can't they find these things?
It's just the vast amount of the Great Lakes. I mean, we are getting to a point where probably satellites will be able to track it. And they've actually done magnetic anomalies. That's how they found the Fitzgerald. The other shipwreck hunters have taken government information and found shipwrecks that way. And, of course, the new fish finders are coming out now that rival even the Klein side scans that were so expensive. So now you can go over it with an ordinary fish finder and actually tell how big the ship is, how many masts are on it, if it's a schooner. And the technology is unlocking a lot of these deep secrets.
Tell us about the message in a bottle from 1913.
There were several of them that came out. Many of them turned out to be fake. There was at least three from the most famous or infamous wreck from the storm, the Charles Price. It was found floating off of Port Huron, so the bottom of Lake Huron, and three bottles came into the river. There's even two guys that came out and said, hey, we survived this wreck. But unfortunately, all 23 people on board drowned. There's only one guy that had a premonition that got off the boat when they were loading coal. And he actually was called in then when all the bodies started coming ashore after the big storm in Goderich to go and identify the crew. And that led to even bigger mysteries because the chief engineer of the Price was wearing a life belt from another boat called the Regina. And it just led to all kinds of spectacular headlines and a lot of mysteries that still haven't been solved today.
You've interviewed a lot of people who have been survivors and rescuers, haven't you?
It's been an amazing career, and as you know, with background in television, that was my forte. Where do you start, with 5,000 shipwreck stories? I decided, why not start where I can find eyewitnesses? And I did, two of them from 1913, two of them from 1940, the big storm.
Wow.
Double the wind strength of the Edmund Fitzgerald. It ripped two freighters in half. I mean, it was just devastating. So I built an amazing archive of these eyewitnesses that not only survived, but also the guys that would go out and rescue them, the helicopter pilot that plucked the German survivors of the Nordmeer off. So there's so many neat eyewitness stories that were there that nobody else was doing, and that kind of became my forte, if you will.
Rick, did you know the late Rich Fisher, who worked at Flint before he went to Detroit?
I wasn't lucky enough to know Rich, and I didn't know he passed either, but
yeah,
I was certainly aware of his talent. I worked at Channel 12 and Channel 5, so to watch him on TV was just amazing, and I'm very sorry to hear he passed.
1975, in addition to the Edmund Fitzgerald disappearing, so did Jimmy Hoffa that year.
A lot of mysteries that came up, and the Fitzgerald one, I think, is just because of the song, we just think of it more and more, and every time that song comes up, it used to be where sailors would tell me they hated that song, but now it's held with more reverence.
What is your take on why the Great Lakes has so much rough weather?
There's a couple of things happening, and believe it or not, we're actually using some of our remote lighthouses out in the middle of the lake to help us understand it. Places like Standard Rock that are 50 miles off of Marquette, out in the middle of nowhere, it's a rock that just appears. The Standard Rock has monitoring equipment that's allowing us to check lake evaporation. And as we look at how that works with the Arctic winds that start to come down and the big storms always seem to pull up some of the Gulf moisture. And when that happens, we get these weird cyclonic storms that hit. And in the Great Lakes, it happens quite frequently. The strength of the Fitzgerald storm is something we see really almost every 5 years. In fact, I've actually seen waves that big in July on the Great Lakes. So it happens a lot, but it just seems very common once September, October, when the evaporation is increased because of the temperature change, that it feeds into these massive storms. And because the lakes are smaller, I mean, they're huge when you're on them, but the shoreline's bounce the waves back and forth, and many of these captains just getting caught in confused seas that are going every which way that they can't control. And in the early years especially, that was devastating to those schooners. It was devastating to the underpowered steamers that were in it, and many of them were lost.
I'll always remember CBS News just all over us in Detroit wanting the video that we had of stuff, debris that had floated from the ship on the shore that we had splashing with the water hitting it and stuff like that. I mean, that's all we had, but they loved it. They jumped on it, and the news director finally apologized to me for being a little too hasty.
And, It's crazy because there really wasn't a lot of debris from the Fitzgerald.
That's right.
That's what led to the mystery. They found a water bottle. They found a couple of life jackets. They found many life rings.
Yep.
And just a couple of pieces of life boats that, you know, came ashore. But that was it. And to find no bodies, that's what led to this big mystery. That's why Gordon Lightfoot picked up the story from Newsweek magazine and thought, I'm going to write a story about this, because it just didn't happen where 29 men would completely vanish. Even the National Enquirer wrote that aliens took the bodies off of there. But truthfully, when you see the devastation of the wreck, you're well aware that it was just so fast they couldn't get out.
Do you think they suffered at all?
No, I mean, obviously, you hate to think about it because it just makes your stomach hurt. And those poor families that lost loved ones, you're talking about 29 people that had, you know, many of them, obviously all of them had parents, but many of them were married, didn't get to see their dads very often. But I think there is some solace in the fact that it was just seconds. And even when that stern inverted, you know, there could have been some trapped air. But I think with just the devastation of everything raining down on you as it flipped over in the back, that I don't think anybody survived that for very long. And if that's any kind of, you know, solace to it, then I hope that, you know, people would think of that.
What do they mean, Rick, when they say it was in two pieces?
It ripped in half, and many people who have looked into airline crashes say it looks almost exactly the same, where the tail section ends up upside down and the bow or the front of the plane survives. The Fitzgerald confused a lot of people when it was initially found by the P3 Orions. They knew it was in a very large area. It sent off a huge magnetic signal, and when Seaward came over and put the sonar on it, they thought it was two pieces upright on the bottom. So when they finally got to dive it in 1976 as part of the investigation of the Coast Guard, they thought it would be all upright. That's what the Seaward had told them. And when they found the stern was upside down, they at first thought that the ROV, or the Underwater Curve 3 unit, had flipped over, because it just didn't make sense to them. But eventually they figured out that somehow that stern, whether through the torque of the propeller or the wrecking process, had inverted and ended up almost a totally opposite direction. The bow is still on course for Whitefish Point, but the stern is actually pointing the other direction. So it's very confusing on the bottom, and it's something that no one has really explained to this day.
What is it about maritime disasters that fascinates you, Rick?
For me, it's the people. First of all, it's the fact that they exist underwater. Most of the terrestrial sites of accidents and big history are erased. But in the Great Lakes, these things are only accessible to divers. So we're seeing things that happened 150 years ago. In the case of Whitefish Point, the graveyard of the Great Lakes, there's dozens of ships that still haven't been found. We found 9 shipwrecks this past summer, and each one of them are so well preserved that the one that we found, the Curtis, actually still had Heinz lumber painted on the side of it, and it's 100 years old. So we're seeing things that no one else gets to see in a preservation that's unparalleled in the world. So these wrecks, even the schooners, have clues on the deck that we can still see. It's also the stories of the people who lived on the ships, you know, that they lived and worked. Mm-hmm. And it is the rescue people. I mean, the people that would put on a life jacket and row out there, and their motto being, we don't have to come back. We have to go out, but we don't have to come back. That just fascinates me, that there's men and women that would do that, and they still do it today in the Coast Guard.
You've looked at lighthouses, too. You're kind of an expert on lighthouses. Are there many different ones all over the place?
There really is. I mean, the ones for me that are most interesting are the ones that people can't get to, and those are those remote ones that mark dangerous reefs out in the middle of the lake. And to think that, you know, men would be stationed out there for weeks on end, and some of them went crazy. And to actually stay on one, I spent a couple of days on Spectacle Reef. I'm on the board for their museum, their actual renovation project that they have in Lake Huron. To be out there, you're just totally lost. I mean, you're out in the middle of nowhere. There's freighters quietly go by. That lifestyle of thinking of storms and the men that have lost their lives going, you know, just even trying to get to the lighthouse, it's just incredible. And their job was to, you know, to mark the way, stay away from here or get into this harbor. They're just the sentinels of really, you know, saving sailors' lives. So I've always been fascinated by them.
How tall are lighthouses, Rick?
At various heights. I mean, we've got some that stand, you know, they've got focal lengths that are 80 feet to 100 feet above the water. There's some that are up on cliffs that are 200 feet. The Whitefish Point has just taken control of one of the lighthouses that's on Grand Island, and it's got a crazy mystery of two of their keepers that vanished and eventually turned up to be killed, and they're 200 feet of straight cliff down to the bottom. So there's many places. Here on island is 180 feet above the water, but it's a massive granite island, and the Huron Islands in Lake Superior. So very remote, and I've been able to interview keepers that have lived there and their families that have been out there, the kids. So to have that eyewitness account, it just really fascinates me.
You don't think the Great Lakes area is like the Bermuda Triangle, where there's some kind of anomaly going on?
Just because most of this stuff is all triggered by a storm, if you look at 75%, you know, of these are all destroyed by killer storms. There's horrible collisions. There's always stuff that makes you scratch your head. I mean, there's many wrecks like the Meteor and the Powabic being lost with over 80 lives. You know, it was a sunny day. They just, for some reason, ran close to each other. Some people say that, you know, they were trying to trade the mailbag between the two ships, and the wheelman made the wrong turn and collided and killed all those people on a pretty clear day. So there's enough of these stories that you just sit there and scratch your head like, what happened? I don't believe there's a triangle, but I certainly believe that, you know, there are certain areas of concentration where these ships have to kind of run together. They're either going around an obstacle or trying to get into a shipping lane to get into the Sioux Locks or whatever. And as you look at the graveyard of the Great Lakes off of Chris Point and Whitefish Point where the Fitzgerald is, it's no surprise that there's, you know, dozens of ships there because they kind of have to go around that point. And Lake Superior is just horrible when it kicks up. It's devastating, and it you know, with waves of 30 to 40 feet tall, you're not going to escape that, you know, without either damage or loss of life.
Have there been aviation disasters in the Great Lakes as well?
There have, and I cover one of them. It's not so much of a disaster. It's more of a balloon aviator that was just crazy for publicity, and they called him the Balloonatic. He actually flew for P.T. Barnum, and his name was Washington Donaldson. They gave him the title of actually being a professor, but they gave that to anybody who flew in a balloon, I think, just because they kind of had to understand the way that wind currents worked. Unfortunately, Donaldson didn't. He got carried over Lake Michigan and almost drowned once on in the late 1870s, and then almost drowned three reporters and himself on Lake Ontario. And then came back to Chicago and actually brought up another reporter, and they both were killed. And they still haven't found Donaldson, but they did find Grimwood, one of the guys, and at least three bottles were found allegedly from that accident. So that's probably the extent of a lot of the aviation disasters I do. But I've been able to, with my reporting, cover the last B-52 missions. I flew those out of Michigan, and I've flown with the Thunderbirds and the Goodyear Blimp. So airplane stories have always fascinated me.
When you were in the small two-person sub, do you get claustrophobic in something like that?
I don't. I mean, I do have claustrophobia. I don't like to have it where I can't move my arms, but it was big enough that I was laying down on some pads, and the pilot actually straddles above you on, like, almost looks like a bicycle seat, and looks up through a conning tower. So you're not fighting for space on a, you know, in the portholes. Delta is a famous little sub that actually Bob Ballard actually used it to go down to Lusitania. Mm-hmm. So it's a famous sub. We used it on the Fitzgerald. We used it when we dove the largest shipwreck in Lake Michigan in 1995, called the Carl Bradley, to put the
I remember that. Remember that one.
So great submarine, very dependable. It can detach its tail like a salamander if you get stuck, and thank heavens we didn't. But the Fitzgerald mission went without a flaw. I mean, we had many missions down there, and the submarine just really came through. And I was, you know, I still have high respect for that sub that's still doing exploration today.
Didn't the Fitzgerald also cruise down the Detroit River once in a while?
So much of it. In fact, its entire life was spent going between Silver Bay, Minnesota, where Reserve had a pellet factory where they would take the iron ore out of the Mesabi Range there, and they'd turn it into iron ore taconite pellets, and it would send it down through Lake Superior, down Lake Huron, through the river to Toledo. And it did it so often, probably 90% of its career, they called her the Toledo Express. So it was almost always in the Detroit River, and even on its last mission, that's where it was destined to go, was to within a mile of where she was actually launched. It was going to Zug Island to make automobiles. The Fitzgerald could carry enough metal in her belly to keep one average car dealer full of cars for a year back in 75.
I love it. Rick, we're going to take a quick break and come back after the top of the hour and take phone calls with you. Rick Mixter with us. His book is called Bottled Goodbyes. It's available on Amazon.com, and we'll talk with him more about that when we come back with your calls.